Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike, where this evening we will be discussing the seventh episode of Twin Peaks, of the first season of Twin Peaks, the episode Realization Time. How are you this evening, Hannah?
Well, I've nearly got a healthy household again. Everybody is going to work in school tomorrow. Hallelujah.
Yes, so that's progress. So we're both a little bit less foggy.
Yep.
I think we were on the last recording. Although, thanks to excellent post-production from myself, we only sounded quite how foggy I actually was. We were only moderately deranged sounding on that. But what are we talking about tonight, Hannah?
Okay, plot synopsis for tonight says, Audrey cons her way into working at the perfume counter where Laura worked and discovers that it's being used as a recruitment post for One-Eyed Jax. James, Donna, and Maddie plan to lure Jacoby away from his office.
Alrighty.
It is directed by Caleb Deschanel and written by Harley Payton.
And according to the episode information that I've got up on the television, it was originally aired on the 17th of May, 1990.
I was 11.
Wow, I was not. Nah. I was at college when this came out. A couple of bits of background on this episode, I guess it's worth mentioning, is it's the penultimate episode of the first season, you know, short season of eight episodes.
Yep.
Caleb Deschanel was a cinematographer, mainly, director of photography and editor, I think, as well. And he's father of Zoe Deschanel and husband of... their mum, whose name I can't remember, who is also in Twin Peaks. And Mary Jo Deschanel, I think her name is.
Let me look that up for you.
Yeah, if you want to look that up. And the writer of this episode, Harley Payton, he was again a TV writer, but would go on to write a bunch of movies as well. And it's interesting because I think in some ways, Harley Payton and Robert Engels, who's another one of the writers, would go on to be the most important non-Mark Frost, David Lynch people on Twin Peaks. They wrote a lot of the mythology of Twin Peaks was really expanded by Harley Payton and Robert Engels. And it's interesting because I've always sort of bristled slightly when people talk about the third season of Twin Peaks and how brilliant it is that it's all written by Mark Frost and David Lynch and directed by David Lynch. And I agree with that. But at the same time, I do think that there's a lot of really good work by other people.
Yeah.
You know, on Twin Peaks, but other writers and directors. And I think that that gets forgotten a lot. And I think that a lot of the elements, right or wrong, that weren't in the third season that people missed were things that came from people like Caleb Deschanel and Dwayne Dunham and Harley Payton and Robert Engels and, you know, Leslie Linka-Glasser and a lot of those sort of people. So I just wanted to kind of shine a light on their work here.
And Caleb's wife is Mary Jo.
I thought so. It's funny because you remember how I said that the first bit of Twin Peaks merchandise I ever bought was the soundtrack CD. And this was one of the first CDs I ever bought. And it was a great... I remember a lot of people were like, oh, you've got that on CD. Because, you know, the music's very ambient and it lends itself to showing off your CD player. And I remember that the inlay sleeve of it was a fold-out thing and it was one of those relationship diagrams of the whole town. So it had all of the characters and then, like, you'd have the lines, like, connected by marriage or connected by work or whatever. And it had the character's name and the actors who played them. And I remember when the show was on, before, you know, it was out on video or there were any books or anything. I just remember looking at that for hours. It really captured my imagination. So when I was trying to remember her name, that was the memory bank that I accessed to do it. I was like, go into the map, Mike. Go into the CD sleeve for the soundtrack of Twin Peaks. And it was there from 35 years ago, that little nugget of information. But before we talk about this episode, I'm going to remind you how you can feedback to us. I don't think we have any feedback because we only put the last episode.
We do have one small piece of feedback.
Oh, okay.
Do you want me to?
Well,
it's not going to take very long. This is a YouTube comment by Kitchen Sink Cosplay.
Oh, okay.
That says, love this podcast. How's the X-Files going, Hannah?
Yes.
So I wanted to, I know it's not a long piece of feedback, but we're cooking with gas with the X-Files.
Before you continue, sorry, this was something I meant to mention when somebody last brought up the X-Files, and I really do want to hear what you've got to say, so please, you know, to do, we will come back to this, is a big part of my Twin Peaks fandom was the magazine Wrapped in Plastic. It was pre-internet, and it was published in America by a couple of brothers, and it was a proper magazine. It had shiny, glossy covers, and they would interview Mark Frost and, people involved in the show. And it was really, before the internet, the only place you could get any information about Twin Peaks, about how it was made, who was involved, all that kind of stuff. And I remember, really controversially, they started giving 3 pages at the back of it over to what they called the X-Files Extra, X with Extra. And it was the first time I ever heard of the X-Files. This was months before it was on TV in the UK. And they were only covering it because David Duchovny was in Twin Peaks.
Right.
And they were like, oh, there's this other show that's on TV that one of the actors from Twin Peaks is in that has kind of a Twin Peaks vibe, and we're really digging it. So we're going to start covering it. And people were a bit snooty at first, But it was so funny because I remember that going, oh, what's this show, The X-Files? And I remember reading episode guides from it and learning about it, and then eventually getting to see it and getting drawn into it like everyone else. So whenever we talk about The X-Files on this podcast, I always feel like this is an ode to Wrapped in Plastic magazine, and this is our X-Files Extra kind of thing. But anyway, sorry, I wanted to get that out of the way. But you were saying.
So we are up to episode 11 of season 6. Last night we watched episode 10, Tithonus. Is it called
Tithonus? No, we watched Tithonus. One Son was the one we watched last night.
No, we didn't.
We did. We watched the two-parter. The Two Fathers is the first parter and One Son is the second one.
Sorry, we did. Sorry, we're further along than I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Tithonus was the one about the photographer.
Sorry, yes. So we're up to episode 13, Aguamala.
Oh, wow, we're really cooking there.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, so sorry, we watched season 6, episode 12 last night, One Son. Sorry, I was looking at the episode descriptions and I don't know, blame COVID. I'm absolutely loving it, and it's kind of amazing. This run has been amazing.
That it's just every episode's just been great for a really long time, hasn't it?
I honestly don't know why you would suggest anyone stops at season 5.
Well, it depends what you want out of the show.
Yeah, but so much happens after the movie.
Well, the two episodes that we've just watched basically explain everything. But pretty much the entire conspiracy has been completely explained now.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's funny, people who were like, oh, the X-Files, they were making it. It's like, no, they weren't. They tell you, they give you the answers.
Yeah, yep, no, absolutely. Yeah. And it's kind of, I had a moment last night when the smoking man is explaining things to Mulder and kind of explaining the background of why things have happened in the way that they've happened. I had a real fringe moment of you're at a point now where you can't just start watching this and hope to know what the fuck's going on anymore.
Yeah, it's so complex.
There's so many players and so much history and detail, you have to have watched it all.
Would you remember when we were in the first season and I said to you how weird it was that it was just Mulder and Scully?
Yeah.
Like, they were literally the only two recurring characters at all.
Yeah.
And it just felt, the first season, which I like, just feels so underpopulated. And then when you see Skinner for the first time and the Lone Gunman for the first time, and it's like, oh, okay, it's becoming the show now.
And it gets away from the stuff that had put me off, like the crazy horror.
Well, the tone has lightened a lot, hasn't it?
Well, it's not that it's lightened. It's just, I mean, some episodes are lighter, but the emphasis has shifted.
Well, it's more...
It's not about what can shock you in terms of what you see. It's more what's behind it.
Do you know why I think that was? I think it was after the creation of the show Millennium, because I think that Chris Carter was always interested in that stuff, but Millennium gave him the outlet for that. So I think a lot of that stuff just got moved over to this other show. And
but you see, I think Fringe has that arc as well, that it starts off very...
It's kind of a gross-out show, isn't it, early on?
Well, Fringe. Very monster of the week.
Yeah.
What crazy phenomenon is going to be the problem this week and how are we going to solve it? And then it becomes about so much more than that.
I mean, The X-Files does maintain that monster of the week thing to the end.
Yeah.
In a way that Fringe didn't. But at the same time...
But
the Monster of the Week episodes are informed by your knowledge of the larger show.
Yeah,
by
and they're
point.
Not, well, as far as I've seen, certainly in this season, they're not, home level.
No.
Woman with no limbs.
I think a big part of it as well was at the end of season 5. They shifted production of the show from Canada to Los Angeles.
Mm.
So it physically becomes a sunnier show. Like they're able to shoot in the desert and they're able to, whereas like in when they shot it in Canada, it necessitated a lot of rainy forests at night as the locale of the show. Whereas when they shot in LA, they could have any environment really they wanted.
I just love how funny, Mulder and Scully are.
Yeah. Well, the
dialogue they're given. I mean, when Mulder's playing basketball, his turn of phrase.
And he's trying
fantastic.
To be all gangster. But the other thing is people forget, and that's why I think Californication worked well, is primarily David Duchovny is a comedic actor.
He's
a comedic actor who can do dramatic, as opposed to being a dramatic actor who can do comedic.
Mm.
That's why I think when he left The X-Files and did films like Evolution, people thought that was the route he was going to go. He was going to go the Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd kind of route.
Yeah.
I'm genuinely surprised that Duchovny's film career never took off, because he was Joss Whedon's first choice for Bruce Banner in the MCU. But no, I'm glad. I mean, I knew you'd like it, but I didn't know whether you would stick with it long enough to realise that.
I'm pleased. I've enjoyed it all, but I'm pleased to be at this point, I think, because it's more my kind of show now.
Yeah.
And just insofar as the way they're approaching it.
Yeah.
And I love all the, conspiracy theory, men in dark alleys,
I think the approach to conspiracy that the show takes is interesting because it's so agnostic.
Mm.
It's not pro anything. It really, the perspective shifts so often in the show that it kind of explores it from every angle. And
the one thing I found very hard to cope with on sort of Harry and Ron fighting levels was...
I know what you're going to say.
What am I going to say?
When Mulder wasn't believing in aliens anymore.
Yeah.
I knew leading into that, I was like, oh, Hannah's not going to like that. You don't like it. You don't like it when the status isn't quo, do you?
The status was not quo. Yeah. I really found that hard to cope with. But I'm through it.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you enjoy it. And the thing is, as far as the whole season ending in season 5, don't get me wrong. It's not that I thought the show went crap. It doesn't. I watched The X-Files to the end and I enjoyed it on the same level the whole run. I don't think it ever really drops in quality. But I didn't know whether you were going to want to watch 9 seasons of a TV show.
How little you know me.
But also, if you weren't going to do that, the movie is a good place to stop to get a real sense of, okay, that's what The X-Files is. But if you keep going, you've got more of that. And if you want more of that, then keep watching.
I think you should know by now that I have one of two settings. I either watch a couple of episodes and never, ever watch it again.
Or absolutely refuse to watch something. There's a few of those where I know you weren't vibing with something and in a different circle. The classic one of those, because I've carried on watching it, is the 12 Monkeys TV show. It breaks my heart because I'm into the second season of that and every episode I'm watching it and just thinking, Hannah would love this. But
it just wasn't for me at that time.
But it takes two or three episodes for you to go, oh, that's what this is. I wasn't sure at first, but every time I watch an episode now, I'm just like, why am I not watching this with Hannah? Because this is just so...
But we watch enough together.
And there's a... Sorry?
Got to have our own interests.
No, we do. That's all the stuff
we'll have nothing left to talk about.
we do. But that's the stuff that I watch and think, oh, Hannah wouldn't like this. But I do. You know, that's like... But yeah. So it is what it is. But cool. Okay, well, should we watch some Twin Peaks?
100%. All right, so we hear our daughter's footsteps.
We're going to hit pause. We're going to watch episode 7 of season 1 of Twin Peaks, and then we'll come back and tell you what we thought of it.
Okay.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
We're back, so we've just finished watching episode 7 of Twin Peaks, the episode Realization Time, the penultimate episode of the show's first season. So
Hannah, aka Penguin Joe and the man with the massive head go and play cards in Canada.
Wow, Penguin Joe. Very catchy. That should be the IMDb bumper description.
That could be the alternative name.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Well, I mean, we've talked before about how these episode titles are unofficial. And I've got to say, I don't actually like the episode titles that they've got. They don't sound like something that Mark Frost and David Lynch would have. Like Realization Time. And one of the episodes is called May the Giant Be With You. And they just don't have the feeling of...
Okay, but we're not getting bogged down in that.
No, it was the numbering that we were getting bogged down in. But the titling of the episodes, it's a necessary evil to help communicate to listeners which episode we're covering. But I haven't actually pointed out at any point that I just don't like... I don't like the fact that they have become... because originally they're written in German, so they're translations from German... So they're quite inelegant in the way that they're done. And I just think that if Mark Frost and David Lynch had given the episode titles, which they didn't, they would have been better. And I mean, the one thing as well I haven't mentioned, sorry, a bit of a derailing here, but this is a good time as any to mention it, is the Log Lady intros to the episodes. Because on a lot of the broadcasts of the show and on the DVDs, every episode actually has a pre-credit sequence, but it's just a couple of minutes of the Log Lady talking to the camera, talking like weird, cryptic kind of stuff. And they were written and directed by Lynch, and they were done, I think, several years after the show for when it was first put into syndication. I think David Lynch didn't like the idea of previously on. He felt that that was... butchering filmmakers' sort of
against
work.
Against brand.
Yeah, so he was like, well, I'll do something instead for you. A little bit like how in the third episode of season 1, when the studio said, when the network said, we need you to recap what's happened for the new audiences. He came up with the rock-throwing sequence. His kind of crazy Lynchian solution was to have the Log Lady intros. So they were something that was added later. I mean, weirdly, the third season, Twin Peaks The Return, all of those episodes do have names, and they were named by Lynch and Frost, and they're much more appropriate than this. So I just wanted to mention that. But anyway, yes, we have just finished watching this Penguin Joe and
Men with a Massive Head whatever go and Play Cards in Canada.
Whatever the German title of this episode is. So what are your thoughts, Hannah?
I thought Audrey is incredible in this episode.
A lot of memorable Audrey moments.
Yeah, I like the focus on her. I like how Josie's onion layering is coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I can never say
her Majinamic.
Name. Majinamic. Pitches it perfectly at the start of the episode with how the type of upset she is.
It's so realistic.
It is really realistic. And it's not hysterical, but it is, if that makes sense.
It's really real.
Yeah. I just thought she did such a brilliant job. And I really that's probably the most I've enjoyed her acting.
I stood to this
Not that I think she's a bad actor in other bits.
I mean, I maintain that the majority of the strongest performances in Twin Peaks are actresses.
Mm.
There's something about the show.
Well, I just think across the board, there are great performances. It's not coming from one individual person or a couple of people.
But I think because of the whole Lynchian thing of the woman in trouble, that kind of noir trope, I think that there's more room for female actors to play high emotion, whereas most of the strengths of the male performances are more subdued and quirky and often comedic.
Mm.
The female actors get to kind of stretch their legs a little bit more just because of
the nature of the show. I think in this particular episode they do.
But I think generally, because I think if you think about Cheryl Lee in Fire Walk With Me, and you know, you think of Peggy Lipton, you know, just how much she communicates really quietly.
She doesn't even have to utter a word, and she gives a masterclass performance.
And, you know, the scenes of Lara Flynn Boyle, like, talking to her mother about, you know, her realisation about the complexities of moving into adulthood.
Mm.
You know, it's so nicely done. And so much of Twin Peaks is about being a teenager.
Yeah.
And is about the kind of play-acting as adults that does lend it. There is a femininity to that idea.
Yeah.
You know, that idea of the intensity of friendships that I think is something that boys and men maybe don't quite understand how powerful that is, you know. And I think the show gets that across. But any other thoughts? Any other general thoughts about this episode?
Nothing I can think of quite at this moment. What about you?
I've always really liked this episode because it feels that this is one of those episodes where there aren't any kind of Eye of the Duck moments. There aren't any sequences like the, you know, the forest walk in the last episode or, you know, a vibing to Julie Cruise in the Roadhouse type scenes.
Mm.
But it just feels that there's a lot of meat episode.
I do love the fact that, and I mean, you only get this on rewatch, but how much you sort of look forward to that last episode because they've set up where all these characters are going to be at various times.
The night starts in this episode and then it pretty much just carries on.
Yeah.
And then the first episode of the second season, I think, is still the same night. It's almost real time. Well, shall we get into the breakdown of the episode?
Indeed.
All right. Let me just rustle up my notes. So we open up on Audrey and Cooper in room 315 of the Great Northern, where we left them last time. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting scene, this, because I think that this is a great example of how you kind of can't apply the logic of the real world completely to Twin Peaks. Mm. So, you know, we spoke the other, well, last time I think it was, about how, and I realise this episode wasn't written or directed by David Lynch, but how Lynchian things kind of exist outside of the traditional moral compass. So, you know, if you try and apply 2023 sensibilities, it's meaningless.
Mm.
And I think it is interesting because if you look at the dynamic of this scene, the way it's played is Cooper, you know, ultimately does the right thing and says, look, this is wrong. You're a child, basically. I'm an FBI agent and, you know, I've got to do the right thing. You know, on the one hand, if you put the modern sensibility on it, you could say, well, that's not the way to handle that situation. Basically, what he's saying to her is, hey, you know, I'm going to resist the temptation because I'm a good man. Whereas really, morally, what he should say is, I'm here to support you, but this is ridiculous and shut it down immediately.
See, I saw it completely differently to that. I saw it as...
He positions her as forbidden fruit.
Well, no. I to my mind, and maybe this is me just reading it completely wrong, but...
Well, no, there's no wrong.
I read it more as... I like the way he didn't kind of go, oh God, I wish I could, you know.
I think there's a little bit of that though.
No, I didn't feel like there was at all. I felt like he
because he says wanted, what I want and what I need are different things.
But he has a really I like the way he made her still feel good about herself, not like a dumb...
He doesn't make you feel stupid.
Yeah, and you saying, oh, you should have shut it down and say this is ridiculous, da, 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 she would have felt like a fucking idiot.
No, no,
and
you're right.
Yeah, I know I am.
good. I know you do.
I just want to talk without you interrupting me for a minute. I just felt like that was... his way of softening the blow for her. Like, you know, I think you're a lovely, attractive, full of promise kind of woman, but unfortunately this is not what needs to happen right now. You need to have a friend.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I just thought it was a really lovely way of him to approach.
Don't get me wrong, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit because the point I'm trying to make is that regardless of whether you feel that Cooper, through a real world 2023 prism, whether you feel he did the right thing or not, is kind of irrelevant because it's Twin Peaks.
Mm.
You know, there's a bit of that. And so much of Twin Peaks exists out of time and exists within this realm of genre. You know, whereas also, a lot of the time, when for example, you've got things like The Woman in Trouble or The Femme Fatale, that's not the creatives commenting on the real world. That's the creatives commenting on movies from the 40s and soap operas. Yeah, yeah. And
but I think you also have to remember, and this is something we've talked about before, about how Cooper is the embodiment of the perfect person within the Twin Peaks realm.
Yeah. Well, he seems to be.
Yeah, but so this is another facet of him being that righteously perfect character.
Yeah, the Boy Scout.
You know, I think it's a mistake to kind of think that the nefarious sexual thoughts of the men around him what he's having as well.
Well, he processes the world differently. We said before that there is almost a sort of autistic element to the way that he perceives the world. And I think that with Cooper, he's asexual in a sense, but at the same time, he is essentialist in the same way that like Ben Horn and Jerry Horn are with their ice cream and their, you know, Cooper... like takes delight in consumption of the world.
Yeah.
You know, whether that be trees or ducks or pie or coffee or...
He is a very much a don't be distracted by, you know... He wouldn't be someone who listened to a podcast while he walked.
Yeah, but there's nothing. The thing with Cooper though is there's nothing corrupting about his sensualism. You know, his sensualism is he comes from a place of appreciation and celebration, as opposed to a place of
decadence or
carnality.
Yeah, you know? Carnality is good word.
And whereas Ben and Jerry. You know, I mean, Ben and Jerry, you know, there you go. Their sense of sensualism is one of consumption and almost...
Well, it's eroticism in all forms.
Yeah, it's about them.
Mm.
You know, it's not about the thing. It's not about celebrating
it's the thing. It's about how that thing makes them feel good.
Yeah, exactly. But so what we see in that scene is he says to her, look, and there's some really interesting moments in this scene because Cooper, I think this whole episode gives you a really interesting view of Cooper. And this goes a little bit back to what you were saying in the last episode about how you felt that Cooper was inconsistent in his behavior around the log lady.
Mm.
The fact that he was being a little bit kind of callous and a little bit of a city boy about the way he was acting. And I think that there are a number of times where you do see that there are chinks in the armor with Cooper. Like in the pilot, there are moments where he seems to be taking a kind of weird sense of delight and glee in some of the macabre elements of what he's doing. And there's the moment when they're on the shooting range in an earlier episode when they're teaching Andy how to, and they're talking about women and Cooper's talking about somebody from his past and you get a glimpse, a slight glimpse of darkness. And here you get a moment where she talks about secrets. She mentions secrets to him and he says, secrets are a dangerous thing.
Mm.
But then she says to him, do you have any secrets? And he says, no.
Mm.
But there's something about that scene. And probably I'm saying this retroactively, is it almost feels like a very subtle dishonesty from Cooper because clearly he does have secrets, but I think that you almost get the feeling that he's repressed them so much that he genuinely believes he doesn't. And it's like when you see people who are so straight-laced like Cooper, it's like, what are you hiding?
Mm.
You know? And I think that there's a couple of moments in this episode that give you an element of some backstory. There's a bit great little subtle moment when they're with Waldo and Doc's Hayward says, oh, do you want to feed him? And Cooper just backs up and he's like, I don't like birds.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, what's that about? You know, and it's just, it's completely, it's a nothing moment, but a really important moment.
Yeah, but you and I can fully relate to that considering we both nearly pooped ourselves when a bird flew down our chimney and into the fireplace. Yeah.
It's like, have you seen Annie Hall, the bit where they're trying to cook the lobster and it like comes back to life and they're both like climbing up on the table and screaming. It just reminds, whenever I see that scene, I always think
home, I drove up the driveway, both kids in the car, to Mike
standing. I was on the drive and I was like, well, we got to move.
Yeah, standing outside holding a broom. Saying basically that, yeah, we couldn't live there anymore because there was a bird in the lounge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite traumatizing, wasn't it?
It was very traumatizing. And what we both quickly realized is that neither one of us are any good with birds.
We're not bird folk, are we?
We are not bird folk.
So Cooper says to Audrey, look, you know, you need a friend here. We get Andy and Lucy. And I mentioned before about how they're very much like, you know, those Shakespearean characters who are kind of the comedic version of the main ones. And one of the things that I like about the way that they play it as the show goes on and their kind of characters become broader is it's almost as though their children play acting at being adults.
Yeah.
Like when she's like, I'm sorry, Deputy Brennan, but I have to do a report. It sounds like our daughter.
Yeah,
you know, we're trying to kind of, and you see a lot of that in Twin Peaks. It's like, you know, again, the log lady with her tea party. in the last episode, you see these people kind of, you know, what is it millennials call adulting? You know, it's like they're adulting. And we see Lucy get a call from a doctor. And another thing that I like about this episode is that this is the broadening of, this is Twin Peaks becoming a show, yeah. A TV show. And it's like what you see is the writers and the creators going, okay, well, this might be something that goes on for years. So we have to think about the show as this larger thing that could run for 5, 10, 15
and the
years.
The strains, you know, that are out there.
You don't know. I mean, the show would only go on to run for 2 seasons, but, you know, I mean, Dallas was on its, like, 9th season by this point. So you can see them starting to look at, okay, how granular can we go with the storylines and the characters and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think the stuff that you see with Andy and Lucy is them trying that out. We see Doc Hayward and Truman trying to get through to Waldo because obviously, you know, the minor birds practice mimicry. Mm-hmm. So they're thinking that this could be a way of them getting clues. This is where you get Cooper's moment of, I don't like birds. And I love his body language. The whole scene, he's just uncomfortable.
I love the fact that Doc Hayward doesn't think the grapes are good enough for the bird. Like, they're not fresh enough.
Yeah, they're right on the edge.
Yeah. So wants to go and get some apples.
Yeah. We see Cooper talk about his voice-activated dictaphone. Mm-hmm. We see Leo watching Shelley and Bobby. I've got a note here about how good, you mentioned it before, about how good Mae Chinamic is in the crying scene. Like, what she does that's really great that you very rarely see. I mean, now people call it ugly crying, but where, you know, when you're really upset and you can't catch your breath, she really captures that. And it's a great snotty kind of unselfconscious performance.
The one that got me was when she said, where am I going to hide?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go?
Yeah, it's a sort of desperation of that.
Where am I going to hide? Yeah. Like, I can't hide from this man. He knows everybody.
Yeah. And it's funny as well because we've talked before about how you've got all of these genres and character types and acting styles in Twin Peaks mashing up. And this is where you really see it because, I mean, Dana Ashbrook is a good actor, but he's very much a pretty boy actor who was in a bunch of teen comedies and horror movies in a scene with a legitimately good actor. Mm. And you can really see that. And it's not like he comes off badly, but it's kind of like he's like, don't worry, I'm good. And he's kind of like doing jaw-clenching kind of TV acting.
I did laugh at the fact that he goes, I'm going to sort Leo out. I'm going to sort James out. Like, James is your issue.
Yeah. You can imagine a kind like, of going, why are we angry with James again?
Like Shelley doesn't give a shit about James. Mm.
Shelley should actually be slightly offended that Bobby is. You'd be pissed off with me. This is a random tangent here, but if I was Bobby Briggs, you'd be pissed off with me that I wanted to get revenge on James.
Yeah.
Because you would see that as some kind of lingering.
Love your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah. You shouldn't even care.
Yeah.
You
should be thanking him.
Yeah. So we get a moment in the Palmer house where.
I love that I'm so easy to read.
Well, you know, it's been 10 years, Hannah.
It's been longer than that.
Well, of marriage. So we see. Donna, James and Maddie listening to Laura's tape in the Palmer house. And I love the way that you see this a few times. Whenever we're in the Palmer house, the camera just floats. It's like got this weird point of view almost. It's a little bit like Halloween when you're Michael Myers walking down the corridor. Mm. The other thing as well that I loved about this, which was a great little sort of period detail, is the stereo, the sort of mini ghetto blaster that they're listening to, is one of those white cream ones with the pink buttons. That was such a 1990 kind of thing. I'm pretty sure my sister had one of those.
All that they needed was a button to put the mega bass on.
Yeah, mega bass. it felt very much of that era.
Mega bass was like you were suddenly transported into the future when you put that on.
Oh, shit got real when you hit the mega bass. We go over to the perfume counter at Horn's department store. One little detail I've never noticed before, I don't know whether this is because it was in HD or not, but is on the perfume counter, you've got like a standee, a cutout of obviously somebody who's meant to be a famous person endorsing it.
Yeah.
It's Jade from Invitation to Love.
Oh, is it?
I've watched this, I've seen Twin Peaks countless times, but I've never made that connection. I'm like, of course, if you can have a celebrity, because, you know, in the real world, we'd have, oh, Christ, I don't know, who are famous people now? I don't even know.
Britney Spears.
I always think of the Louis C.K. thing about how, you know, you're getting old. He's like, to me, he's like, young people are like Britney Spears. And he's like, she's probably like older than me now, somehow. It'd be like having, I don't know, the chick who plays Wednesday Addams. She's the hot thing at the moment. Oh, right,
yeah.
So, of course, in Twin Peaks, it's Jade from Invitation to Love, because it's the only TV show that exists, because Twin Peaks exists in a bubble where, you know, they don't watch Dallas in Twin Peaks.
No.
You know, Dallas doesn't exist in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
You know, it's that.
I do think David Duchovny could play Chet.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
It kind of looks like it is him wearing a wig.
Yeah. And I love, a spoiler alert, but I love that they get David Duchovny back in season 3 as well. But he's transitioned further at that. Well, sorry, she, being talking about the character, has transitioned further at that point. So we see, I love the sequence for a number of reasons that I will bore you with, where Audrey is watching Emery Battis talking to the girl about Blackie. And about her, so much stuff. There's loads of really great, like quietly great moments in this episode, memorable moments. Because
I just love how unbothered she is.
She's smoking.
Yeah.
She's smoking, hiding in the wardrobe.
Yeah.
And why is there a wardrobe in an office as well? But I will tell you why there is a wardrobe in an office. It's because it's a kind of, I'm pretty sure it's a Blue Velvet reference. Like there's a famous sequence in Blue Velvet, which often people say is the eye of the duck scene of the whole of Lynch's career, where Jeffrey Beaumont, the character played by Carl McLachlan, who's obviously meant to be a David Lynch familiar, is hiding in Dorothy's wardrobe. And he watches through the slats this horrific, bizarre scene between her and Dennis Hopper. And first and foremost, David Lynch is a voyeur, and he invites voyeurism in people. And that image of Jeffrey with the light shadowing on his eyes from the slats in there is a kind of key art image for Blue Velvet. And often when you see things like articles about David Lynch or books, often that's the image that's used, is the image of Carl McLachlan looking through the slats. It in some ways encapsulates David Lynch.
Yeah.
And that's what this scene is. This scene is a recreation by another director of that sequence. So there's that. There's the fact that, you know, Audrey is just such a spoiled, confident in her, you know, I'm Audrey Horne, I get what I want. That she doesn't even put the cigarette out when she's hiding. She's got that much contempt.
She is so not worried about getting caught.
No. But also the actual scene that she's watching is great. You know, the fact that the girl comes across as all naive, but you see the scene afterwards, she knows the score. She knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And she's been condescended by this old white guy who thinks she's this kind of dumb, innocent girl. But she's actually getting something out of it.
She's playing him.
And she's cynical as fuck afterwards in the scene.
Yeah.
You know, where she's just
what am I going to do with a horned horse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. So I just really like that sequence because there's so much going on within the kind of the oeuvre of David Lynch. And the directors who come in after Lynch who are trying to emulate him, it's interesting to see that they're going to his non-Twin Peaks work for ideas about what's Lynchian. And that makes sense, I guess. So we see, you know, Battis and the hostess. He talks about Black Rose. I like the scene where, and again, lots of small moments, where you've got Hank playing dumb with Shelley, where you see Shelley. He's basically, you get the impression that she's kind of not terribly well-educated, but ultimately a good-natured person.
Yeah.
She just doesn't understand the world.
No, and probably why she's ended up in the situation she hears.
Yeah, I mean, she's clearly had no father figure in her life, you know. But it's funny how, you know, you see Hank sort of playing her, like he's sort of like talking about being in prison, and she's like, well, you know, God, it must have been really difficult for you. And he's like being like, well, you know, not as difficult as it was for the lives I've ruined and all that kind of bullshit. And he's saying, well, you know, was it Pete that helped her? And she's like, no, Ed. He's like, oh, yeah, Ed. And when she walks off, he's like, yeah, big Ed. I expected him to, like, produce his domino and give it a little suck. Give like, little, or he was already packing it in, like, the side of his cheek, and he was just like, yeah, big Ed. And just sort of like, you know, like a credit card coming out of the cash machine. It was like, yeah, big Ed. I'm going to suck the shit out of this domino for a little while. But it felt like a domino moment, and he didn't. I was like, Hank, have you lost your domino confidence, mate? Double down, own it.
It's so funny you say that, because I thought the domino was missing in that. Yeah, yeah.
You know what this scene needs? More cowbell. No, a domino. so we see.
Maybe that could be like, along with Hannah's leg of beef, that could be another thing, a domino moment.
Yeah, a producing the domino moment.
Yeah.
I like the moment where Truman walks in to see Hank in the double R. And this is another example of very quiet moments that tell you a lot about the character, is how much contempt Truman has for Hank. Mm. And he says to Cooper, and you can see Cooper doesn't know Hank, so he's reserving judgment, but you can see that he's a little bit like, yeah, Truman's my boy. Mm. I'm getting a vibe here, so I'm going to. So he's looking at him suspiciously. And they have a chat. And, you know, Hank quite rightly says to Truman, well, look, I've done my time. I'm trying to make good, you know. Mm. And Truman's like, do you believe people can change? I don't, you know. And it tells you a lot about him. And spoiler alert, it's a very small detail, but you learn later that Hank was one of the Bookhouse boys, and him and Truman were best friends. And that he kind of went bad,
right?
You know. So what you're actually seeing here from Truman is betrayal.
Mm.
You know, is that it hurt him that Hank went bad.
Yeah.
But I do believe that Truman is the sort of person who he trusts easily, but, you know, forgives with great difficulty.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you see. Well, with I'd his say
rate, once he's done, he's. He's done for life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at Josie, he's very trusting because of his feelings towards her. But, you know, once you're discommunicated, then that's it. You know, you like you say, you're kind of, you're dead to him. Mm. So this is where you get the great moment where Cooper says, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You know, every day I like to treat myself to a cup of coffee.
Treat yourself.
Treat yourself. And it's for gleeful. I love the way he pushes the cup towards Truman as well. It's just like, come on, dude. And I think that there are some real life lessons there. And I think that this is part of, again, people talk about Twin Peaks very much in regards to the surreality and the darkness and the craziness. But I do think that there is something... There is a bright core to Twin Peaks that's also very appealing.
Mm.
And I think that moments like that speak to that.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of taking pleasure in life.
Taking pleasure where you find it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just sort of living in the moment, I guess. That's something that Cooper's very much about, is the, I always call it, looking at the clouds, you know, like I try to have a looking at the clouds moment every day where you just, you know what it's like, you know, when you're a kid and you're just sitting in the grass and you're just talking to your friends and you're not doing anything and you're picking the grass out and looking at it and looking at the sky and you're just having pure experience. And that's something that adults forget. And I think that there's something about Cooper that is connected to that and he's still in touch with that. And that's part of that kind of his deductive methodology as well. So we see...
I would like to say, though, he's got staff to be able to have those moments.
He's got what, sorry?
Staff. You know, he's got Diane.
Oh yeah.
Who, you know, sorts everything. So
oh, it's a luxury. You know, yeah. it's like I always joke at work about. Really, you'll see people. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn because of my work, and you'll see people on LinkedIn going, "Hey, you know, it's important to disconnect from work and spend time with your family and not." And it's like, well, that's great, but I've got loads of shit that has to be done by 3 o'clock. You know, so my family ain't getting none of me. It is one of those kind of things. I like I'm becoming a bit of a broken record here, but there's a lot of very small moments here. And I love the way that they use Invitation to Love. I think this episode and the next episode are kind of the peak.
Very intertwined.
They use it. In fact, I think in season two, you hear it on in the background, but I don't think it comes back. So I feel like this is the point where they're kind of using up the Invitation to Love. And you get a great moment where you see Nadine Hurley watching Invitation to Love. And
eating bonbons.
Eating bonbons. And you're seeing in the sequence Chet, the bullied character, shooting the big bully.
Yeah.
That's what's playing out. And you see that sequence and the after effects of it play out over the next couple of episodes. But I love the way that Dean's like, you tell him, Chet. No, you show him, Chet. You show him all, you know. And
I always thought Chet was the bully one.
No, Chet's the...
Oh, so, like, if anyone heard me say...
Yeah, no, I knew who you meant. Yeah, you meant the cackling guy.
The guy with the bad...
I might be wrong, actually. It's entirely possible.
No, I'm probably wrong.
But this is where you get the scene where we see that Nadine was rejected by the Drape Company, and she talks about this new life that she got. And the thing
is... it's not a Drape Company. She's rejected by the Patents
Company, yeah.
Office.
And... the thing that I like about this is, and this is kind of ahead of its time in the way that the sensitivity that Twin Peaks shows towards people who, you know, I don't know if you want to call it mental illness, but whose quirks and eccentricities can be amusing and entertaining, but it never dehumanizes them.
Mm.
Like, you feel for Nadine in this scene.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I mean, she's portrayed as a kind of, you know, a harridan and she's in the way of Ed's happiness, and she's portrayed as this sort of barrier to happiness.
Mm.
But at the same time, we do get to see her inner life, and we do get to see that. And I genuinely feel that Ed does love her.
Yeah.
You know, and you see how, when she's giving up, how much it upsets him.
Yeah.
To see that, like, he's like, don't you dare. And I love the way that when he's like, don't you give up, don't you dare give up, the Invitation to Love music's on the TV in the background, kind of commenting on the melodrama
of the situation.
At the same time, it's not mocking it.
No.
And that's a real...
It's a real fine line.
Yeah, it's a tightrope. So we get a scene with Pete and Harry, where he's geeky little touch where Pete shows him the taxidermied fish.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I got this done from Tim and Tom's taxidermy. One of the only pieces of expanded universe Twin Peaks that came out around the time, aside from Cooper and Laura's diaries, was the Access Guide to Twin Peaks, which was this fake tourist guide that David Lynch and Mark Frost did. And that has an entire section on Tim and Tom's taxidermy. And it's Mark Frost and David Lynch, or Tim and Tom, in all of the photographs of it. And it's this kind of deep cut. And I had that book and I read it. And then when I went back and rewatched Twin Peaks, when I finally got it on video, I was like, oh, Tim and Tom's taxidermy, that's the thing. So Harry asks Josie where she was at the motel. And he says that Hawk saw her in the car watching. And I was really relieved on the rewatch to hear him say that Hawk saw them. Because I don't know if you remember the scene, but you know how I've been making a bit of a point about the slight racial insensitivity about Hawk the Tracker? In that scene in the original episode, you see Hawk spot some petrol on the floor and he touches it. In this scene, they mentioned that Hawk actually saw her. And I was so relieved because I was thinking, what, did he, like, get the petrol and sort of lick it and be like, that's Josie's. Like my Navajo senses are telling me that that's Josie Packard's petrol like from her car. But no, he actually saw her, so that's a relief.
It's Josie flavour.
Yeah. What? It's kind of like, because of course we all know
that's Packard petrol.
We all know that Native Americans inherently have the ability to recognize people by the taste of their car's petrol. But no, he actually saw her, so the show is off the hook in that regard. Cooper rocks up in a tux and tells the guys about the Bureau money that they've got. And I love how much Cooper and Ed are just loving it.
Yeah.
I mean, to them, it's like a jolly boys outing, isn't it? They're like, oh, we get to play. We get to like wear wigs and wear tuxedos and spend money that's not ours.
I tell you what, Ed is not wrong. He has got a fucking huge head.
I relate to that because I've got quite a big head as well. I struggle with headwear.
I know you do.
So whenever I try to think, I always just think of that. It's better be a big wig because I'm going to have a real big head. Big head early. That should be. It's all in the name, isn't it?
It's.
Maybe that's how he got cast.
It's just quite the amazing. quite an amazing look for him.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, and also, it's just. It makes no sense how little they actually try.
Yeah.
To cover it up. I mean, we're in TV show territory at this point. I mean, and again, it's a shifting genres. It's like we've now got this established thing that anytime Cooper's out on some kind of investigative thing, that's its own genre.
Yeah.
You know, with its own rules at this point.
But I love that Cooper still wants to make the Bureau money.
He wants a return.
Just sort of speaks to his character. You know, he wants the Bureau to be up at the end of the day.
He's responsible, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Harry tells Truman about Josie's conspiracy. And this is a very telling scene about their relationship because Cooper asks him, how much he knows about Josie, you know, her life prior to marrying Andrew Packard and moving to Twin Peaks. Truman basically says, no, I trust her. And Cooper's like, well, that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
So he questions it, but ultimately, you know, his boy.
Yeah, goes with Truman.
I've always loved the guy who plays the insurance agent in the scene with Catherine
Martell.
He's
great.
I think that's like he's only in like a couple of scenes in the entire show, but there are certain actors who just elevate small roles and he's one of them. Like he just plays this kind of opportunistic, nervous, you know, twitchy guy. Because
I don't see him as being nervous. I see him as being quite cunning.
Yeah, opportunistic.
Yeah.
And basically what's happening in this scene is we learn that Josie and Ben have put out a fraudulent insurance policy on Catherine and that she's the recipient of caddish behaviour.
Yeah. And quite frankly, does not like it.
No. The other thing this scene reminded me of as well is you don't see briefcases anymore, do you? You notice that? Used to be briefcases everywhere. People just don't use them anymore.
I have not been in a briefcase world for a very long time.
Nobody has, because they don't exist anymore, Hannah. So
I'm sure they do.
This is where Ed says that he thinks it wonders whether it will fit because he's got a big head. It's that a storm begins, which is never a good sign in a David Lynch film.
Right.
So, you know, we've got lightning and thunder. We've got rain. We see Waldo get shot. Do you know that it's Cheryl Lee does the voice of Waldo?
Does she?
Yeah. It's one of those weird little facts that when you know it, it's really obvious when you actually watch it.
I felt bad for the donuts.
Well, I was always surprised. I am always surprised that shot of the donuts with the blood on them wasn't used more as a piece of key art for Twin Peaks. Because to me, that feels like such a great summational image of Twin Peaks, you know, blood on donuts. I mean, that's Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised they've never used that for like the DVD covers or any of that kind of stuff. Barney and Fred are Cooper and Ed's pseudonyms as well, right up there with Ben and Jerry and Cagney and Lacey. No, nobody had those good names. So Ed and Cooper are really enjoying themselves as well.
They're having a wonderful time.
There are a couple of moments in this episode that really challenge how much we should spoil about this show.
Mm.
What I will say is that if you have never watched Twin Peaks before, flick forward about 2 minutes on this podcast. But I want to mention Leland when Maddie leaves. That's a really strong hint.
Oh, my God, yeah.
That I didn't get at the time. I think most people didn't get at the time. Mm. But with hindsight, because I think we've got so used to Leland just being kooky.
Mm.
And I think this is how clever the producers were of the show, in the sense that they normalized Leland's weird behavior. But this moment that is actually more ominous, he's just sitting in silence in the dark, staring ahead at nothing.
Mm.
And he looks at Maddie leave. And of course, what we learn later is the point of view that we see watching Bobby and Maddie with the wig on later on. That's Leland.
Yeah.
With Bob possessing him.
Yeah.
Watching them. And he followed Maddie out of the house.
Yeah.
But that's not obviously immediately obvious in this, but I wanted to mention it at this point. So welcome back, those who fast forwarded a minute. And that was pretty much exactly a minute. So I'm glad about that. But yeah, just wanted to mention that. So we see Maddie as Laura, and you get a moment of Donna just looking like the spare wheel when she gets out the car.
She does look a bit nervous as to what James's reaction is going to be.
She's like, am I just like putting a snack on a silver platter for my my current boyfriend here?
Yeah.
And, you know, and the way that the scene's shot really kind of heightens that. We get the Icelanders singing 100 bottles of beer on the wall. I love how crap Ben Horn is at humouring them.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, you must tell me, teach me more of these incredible songs. But you can see he's kind of just like, oh, can we wind it up? Whereas Jerry, you can see why they're such a good partnership.
Yeah.
Because Jerry can party all night.
And he's just into it.
Yeah. And he's a people person.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Ben's more of a negotiator.
He wants the business done.
And obviously, you know, they don't have Leland anymore to do all of that kind of, like, hard bargaining for them. Again, we get the ice cream, the food fetish, the sensualism of the Horn brothers. We see Hank hanging out with Josie. I love the way he's got his leather jacket collar turned up.
Oh,
so it's in danger mode.
He's a tough.
Yeah. We see Audrey go to see Blackie, and she says Hester Prynne, the character from Scarlet Letter, is her name. And, of course, she gets caught out by Blackie immediately, and again, a very iconic moment. I think Sherilyn Fenn did this on the Letterman show when she was being interviewed for the time, because it's something she can really do. She was doing just on the set one day, and she showed David Lynch that she could do this thing, and he's like, that's going in the show, that is. We see the young detectives call Jacoby.
Yep.
They leave a video cassette at his door, and weirdly enough, this is one of those, I think, David Lynch stealing from somebody else who did Twin Peaks, because that's used as a plot device in Lost Highway, the 1997 David Lynch film, where the characters get these mysterious video cassettes turning up at their door. So it's kind of odd, but it's sort of fed back that way as well. And the other thing that occurred to me as well is that when we think of Cheryl Lee, we think of, you know, Laura Palmer, but she actually probably played Maddie more than she played Laura Palmer.
Yeah, of course she did.
You know, I mean, she plays, I mean, obviously her performance of Laura Palmer in Fire Walk With Me is very significant. It's the lead performance in that film, and it's a really incredible performance. But just pound for pound, minute for minute, she spends more time playing Maddie Ferguson. And it's funny because of the, you know, Laura being over the end credits and her kind of ubiquity throughout the show.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget how little Laura is actually in the show and that it's Maddie. We see that somebody's watching them. We see Bobby drop a bag of coke into James's gas tank, Easy Rider style. And it's funny, moments, I think this is alluding to something you were talking about earlier on, where moments like that and the bit with the insurance salesman and always, it does feel a lot like we're being set up for the season finale.
Mm.
It feels like there's lots of big shit coming, and this episode feels like there's a lot of that positioning.
Even just Cooper being in the tux, you know, it's just nice.
Yeah.
Like, you can see, it's like, we're getting to the season one finale.
Yeah, stuff's happening a little bit differently. And then as we take it home, We see somebody watching Maddie, and then we go to the end credits. One thing I do want to mention, I've been meaning to mention this for weeks, is how much I like the Lynch Frost logo. You know, that kind of electrical sound, and it just feels, it's so abrasive, and
he's all about electricity.
And but weirdly enough, one of the most powerful, unexpected moments of nostalgia I had when the third season, you know, 30 years later happened, was we watched that for the first episode, and it was very different and kind of a lot and exciting and crazy. But at the end of the end credits, the Lynch Frost logo, and I was just like, oh my God, that's like, I didn't realize how much that meant to me until it came back into my life.
Yeah.
It was like those guys working together again. Any final thoughts before we wrap up, Anna?
No, just bring on the final.
Yes, let's go. We'll be finishing up the season very soon. Quick reminder that we appreciate feedback. I also realized that I didn't tell people how they could give us feedback earlier on in the episode, so I will do that now. Email is very much appreciated at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. You can also leave comments on our YouTube channel. Please check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker versus Punter, His Film, Her Movie, Film Bastards, The Good, The Bad and The Odd, and We Talk Without Rhythm podcast. And we are on Instagram and Twitter. In both instances, we are at RewatchProj. That's Rewatch, P-R-O-J. And also, we appreciate views on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. So what is the tale of the tape for the next episode, Hannah?
The next episode is called The Last Evening. Synopsis says, Audrey is hired at One-Eyed Jack's, but is caught in a trap when her father arrives.
She's caught in a trap.
Cooper gets Jacques Renaud to reveal the details of Laura's last night in the cabin. Deputy Andy saves Truman's life and apprehends Renaud.
Right.
It's directed by Mark Frost, and it is written by Mark Frost as well.
I might add my interview with Mark Frost to the end of that episode, because we talk about this episode quite a lot, because it's the only episode of Twin Peaks that he wrote and directed.
Yeah.
And we kind of get into the weeds.
That's good
about that episode quite a bit. So I'll probably tack that on to the end of that one. But for now, that is us, and we will see you soon.
See you later.
Bye-bye.